In April of this year,
Wisconsin Public Radio
and the Educational Communications Board
put out a statewide call. They were looking for young journalists to interview people who were personally affected by World War II.
They hope to document stories from veterans
to coincide with Ken Burns' new documentary,
The War.
Four high school students answered the call.
That's us.
And from there, the project grew. We talked to soldiers, but we also met with nurses,
prisoners,
citizens,
and protesters. Their stories were tragic.
They had a counterattack. Your unit was completely wiped out.
Frank?
Somebody's shooting at you, aren't you going to be scared? If you didn't, you were an idiot.
Inspiring.
My dad said, things look very rough now, but it'll be better. We'll find a job. Thank God we're in America.
Even humorous.
Now that we're all dying off, everybody's interested in us.
Together, they offer a full picture of American life during wartime.
A life with more nuance than what you may have read in history class.
For the next hour, we'll present these stories to you.
I'm Joe Meeker from Wanakee High School.
I'm Jake Pride from Shabazz City High School in Madison.
I'm Justin Weimer from Nicolay High School in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
I'm Natalia Hoken from Madison East High School. And this is The War Project.
The War Project.
On Wisconsin Public Radio.
We begin the hour in the skies of Europe. Joe Meeker talks to two pilots who risked their lives to advance the Allied charge towards Germany.
June 6th, 1944, D-Day. As the American forces below clamber onto the beach, bombers fly overhead.
Ships and planes and all were headed to France and Germany. There were so many ships, it looked almost like there was a bridge between England and France. There were barrage balloons attached to keep the Germans from strafing the ships. And it was just quite an exciting morning.
Robert Bassnett, a Missouri native, flew as part of two missions that day. Bassnett was a bomber pilot for the 416th Aerial Bombing Group, and on D-Day, they were given a very important task.
We bombed a crossroads back behind in Normandy, back behind where... Utah Beach or wherever they made their landing, to keep them from bringing up reinforcements.
The mission was definitely dangerous. It wasn't as if the Germans were simply going to let the 416th knock out crucial targets.
Well, the enemy had very good anti-aircraft fire. They were experts. And so we got lots of anti-aircraft fire, especially over the targets and stuff.
Fortunately for Bassnett, conditions were almost completely clear on D-Day. It was a very welcome change from some of the other missions he had undertaken.
If you had a lot of cloud cover, you couldn't bomb. And then England had such bad weather in the wintertime, a lot of times you would take off on a mission and then the field would be socked in when you got back. And sometimes you had to go to some other field. So weather was very important.
Over the course of his military career, Bassnett flew over 60 missions as a member of the 416th Bombing Group. The missions ranged in difficulty and danger, but Bassnett says that every time he stepped into a cockpit, the one emotion he felt more than all others was fear. Bassnett, always a realist, said a few choice words about those who claimed they were never scared during their tour of duty.
Well, I think if you didn't, you were an idiot. Somebody's shooting at you, aren't you going to be scared? People said they weren't, I think they were lying.
Thankfully, Bassnett never allowed his fear to paralyze him, and he was still ready and willing to complete any task he was assigned.
I think you can be fearful and still do your job. I never saw anybody that refused to go or anything, but I don't think that it wasn't like going out for a round of golf or something.
Of course, the 416th had more than just the enemy to worry about. They were actually one of the first groups to utilize the A-20 bomber. And as fellow 416th member Ralph Conti notes, the effectiveness or even safety of these planes was as yet unknown.
Well, we didn't know. We were the first one. We were under the so-called baptism of fire to the extent of these A-20s were at that time the fastest bomber in the 8th or 9th Air Force.
Ralph Conti, another Missouri native, is definitely knowledgeable when it comes to the history of the 416th. In fact, Conti has even written a book on the subject, entitled Attack Bombers, We Need You. Conti was a navigator and bombardier general in the 416th. He was, of course, responsible for the navigation and target identification on his plane. Conti was also part of a mission on D-Day, though while Bassnet kept reinforcements out, Conti kept Germans from bolting.
All of the Germans were escaping that Falaise Gap through France on a particular bridge, which was the only remaining bridge over the Seine River, where Germans could escape to go back to their front lines. And it was our duty to knock out those bridges.
The mission was definitely intense. The Germans were intent on filling the sky with as much anti-aircraft fire as possible.
When we attacked that bridge, there were 36 of our planes went in, but 11 of them were knocked out of the sky due to the heavy flak that protected those bridges.
Unlike Robert Bassnet, Conti was rarely scared when he flew his missions. Of course, he's no idiot. He was simply very focused on his task.
Well, you know, the only thing that you have to think about is you have a job to do. You're aiming that special bomb site that we have, and you're concentrating on that, and you just hope that you don't get shot out of the sky.
However, Conti's tour of duty with the 416th was more than just taking part in missions. As the group moved from country to country, sleeping in cramped tents, flying together, even exploring the cities in which they were stationed, the members of the group formed close friendships.
We were very, very close, most especially with those that were in the original cadre of the formation of the group. We were very, very close. I knew every one of the other pilots and bombardiers and navigators.
The group now tries to have a reunion once a year. Unfortunately, the number of attending veterans has dwindled from over 100 to only 2 at this year's reunion.
Oh, it makes me feel bad knowing that, you know, my buddy from this guy, from this group or that squadron that I knew very well, we used to go on 48-hour passes to London or Paris with them, and all of a sudden they're not there anymore, and or they're tied up because a family member is ill, for instance, in my particular case.
Conti now worries that the history of the 416th is disappearing along with its veterans.
The history is dying, as all history does, when people become involved in other environments.
Conti does his best to keep the history of the group alive. In addition to his book, Conti also frequently speaks to high school social studies classes in the hope that they'll perhaps be inspired to learn more about World War II. Unfortunately, Conti frequently finds that the only receptive audience is that of other veterans.
My book was mostly about the history of our particular group, and the people who are most interested in that are members of our group and the family members of our group.
In a perfect world, everyone would know about the 416th's amazing history, the missions they flew, the friendships they forged, and the people they were. But, for now, Conti can take solace in the fact that as long as there are records of some kind, the history will never truly die.
The information is out there, and just a question of having people gather to listen to it.
For The War Project, I'm Joe Meeker.
There's a Star-Spangled Banner waving somewhere in a distant land so many miles away. Only Uncle Sam's great heroes get to go there, where I wish that I could also live someday. I'd see Lincoln, Custer, Washington, and Perry, Nathan Hale and Colin Kelly too. There's a Star-Spangled Banner waving somewhere, waving o'er the land of heroes brave and true. In this war,
the location of our next story may surprise you. One brave nurse shares her World War II experience with Natalia Hoken.
Signe Cooper was an 18-year-old nursing student at UW-Madison when World War II began in 1939.
I guess our reaction was one of concern because a lot of us had brothers, a lot of us had boyfriends. you know, that we knew were going to get caught up in the service. And I would say it was probably a feeling of, I want to say anxiety. We knew that things were never going to be the same.
Cooper joined the service and was stationed at Fort Belvoir, Virginia in 1943. She received no special training and in 15 months boarded a plane to India.
We didn't know where we were going until we were on the plane. And it wasn't that we said, you know, where's India? We all knew where India was. But it was sort of like if we'd guessed where we were going, that would have been about the last place on earth we'd have guessed.
The nurses arrived at the 20th General Hospital, the U.S. Army's largest overseas medical center in World War II.
It was located at a little town called Lido. They were building what was called the Lido Road, a road to deliver supplies to China, which was an ally also.
Engineers building the road encountered a jungle mite that causes a localized form of scrub typhus.
It's called Tuchigamuchi. It was just a name that would roll off your tongue.
However comical its name, scrub typhus infected over 5,000 soldiers in World War II's Pacific Theater. About 5% died.
They were really sick. They just absolutely were laid low. But they were very often confused. And they'd run high fevers.
Effective medicine for scrub typhus was not available, so treatment was a matter of making sure patients were comfortable.
You'll laugh when I tell you this. The drug that they gave us was something called para-aminobenzoic acid, which is now used in sunblock. And you'd try to lower their fever, and you'd try to get them to eat, or you'd try to get something down them, but there really wasn't very much you could do.
Cooper had experience as a psychiatric nurse before the war and was transferred to the psychiatric unit of the hospital, where she treated soldiers traumatized in the Battle of Burma.
They were, I think, traumatized by just being there so long.
The hospital in Lido had surprisingly low mortality rates when you consider its physical construction.
We did have electricity, you know, one bulb in the center of the room. But the buildings themselves had bamboo walls, and this was woven bamboo. So it wasn't all that, you know, it was on wooden frames, but they weren't all that structurally sound.
And the tropical South Asian climate was not always pleasant.
In the monsoon season, which would be in the fall, it rained every day. And what would happen would be your clothes would get moldy, then the rains would stop, and then around Christmas time, in the middle of winter, there would be a small monsoon, and this would be cold. We didn't really have clothes for cold weather. I can remember going on duty with my pajamas under my uniform because it was so cold.
Lido's remote location did not have much to offer the nurses in their free time, so they had to entertain themselves.
Well, one of the nurses where I lived got an old crank-up phonograph.
And she was only able to find one record.
I remember the record that she had. One side was the bolero, Ravel's bolero. And we'd play it, and we'd play it. I don't know what she did with that record. It must have been pretty much worn out by the time we went home. And the other side was Manhattan Serenade. So we'd play one side and then we'd play the others. And we played a lot of cards.
Upon returning to Wisconsin, Cooper worked in the maternity ward at Wisconsin General Hospital, now the UW Hospital. There, she discovered that the war was not a welcome topic of conversation with veterans.
I think that the attitude was, the war is over, let's forget it. But if I would say something like, I should have known better, but if I would say something like, well, now in the Army we did it this way, people would interrupt me. I mean, they didn't want to hear. It was a very funny kind of, you know, you soon learned it. You didn't talk about it.
But today, Cooper is well aware of the interests surrounding veterans and others who served in World War II.
I said, now that we're all dying off, everybody's interested in us.
For The War Project, I'm Natalia Hoken.
Nearly 6 million Jews died during the Holocaust. Justin Weimer reports on the amazing story of Jack DeGola, a Milwaukee resident who survived the genocide.
As a 9-year-old, Jack grew up in a Polish city near the German border. When World War II broke out, his village was immediately taken over.
I happened to be on the street when the German planes came with the machine guns and the shooting. And I couldn't run home. I ran to the first door I could find that was accessible. It was open. Then after it quieted down, I walked home. Thank God my mother and my brother were okay. But our neighbors weren't. They never came back.
The Nazis gathered Jews in the center of town as they appointed individuals to bring them all the watches, jewelry, and other valuable items.
And once they got that, whatever you had on, one shirt, two shirts, a jacket, no jacket, they chased us out of town.
After spending a year in hiding at his mother's childhood home, he, his mother, and brother were discovered by the German army. They were taken to a ghetto with 70 other members of his family.
They were giving orders, raus, raus, with the boots marching, like you see in some of the movies.
Jack also remembers the conditions inside the ghetto.
Well, we were like 30 people in one room, on top of each other. And you had no choice. You're lucky they found you a room.
Of course, this was better than the alternative.
You were fortunate compared to the rumors that they took 300 people in the forest and shot them all in one mass grave for no reason.
The life moved on in the ghetto. There were constant reminders of the Nazis' cruelty.
In the ghetto, I've witnessed a hanging of 20 people, and they wanted to make sure that everybody saw the hanging. You can imagine how terrible that was to stand there and to not to cry or scream or whatever, because they're going to shoot.
Eventually, Jack, assuming the Christian identity of his deceased neighbor and 7 other members of his family, decided to escape through an unhinged fence post. Without knowing if they would ever see each other again, Jack's family went their separate ways.
My mother said, we'll take a chance, not realizing that the war was going to go on for a long period of time.
DeGola ventured from farmhouse to farmhouse while eating corn kernels and fruit, looking for work. Jack suffered through one particularly difficult winter,
where my hands became black and blue, my fingers, and they became very sick. It looked like I'm going to lose, but they're going to fall off. You know, here was Václav Dulcevský. For all this time since I escaped from the ghetto, but something was telling me when I should trust this lady and tell her who I am, she's going to help me. She saved my life, because if my fingers would have fall out, I would have given up. I probably would have died.
Jack was well aware of the consequences if his patron was discovered healing his wounds.
If I would have been found hiding at the laser, they would have wiped off the whole family.
Jack was sent to a widow's farmhouse where he worked the farm until he received an extremely rude awakening.
While I was sleeping up above one night, there's a flashlight in my face. Not knowing who, I saw uniforms. I thought that was the end. They're going to take me down and hang me or shoot me or whatever they're going to do. And they told me to go down the ladder and to the yard. But they were speaking Polish, not German. I turned around and I looked at this one guy and I recognized him. There were two brothers. They were both in the Jewish police in the ghetto.
Jack continued to travel with the partisans until he was freed by the Russian army. Jack looked for his relatives in his hometown and other recovery centers in Poland. In Germany, he joined a group of orphans preparing to move to Palestine. But fate had other plans.
So I got acquainted with the office girl from the Canadian consul. She stopped me and said the Jewish Congress of Canada is sponsoring 500 orphans. If I want to immigrate and go to Canada, I'll be the first one on the list. And that's how I wound up 3 weeks later on a ship on my way to Canada.
Jack began life anew, learning English and training as a furrier. Believing his family dead, he was shocked when he heard news from his mother.
When she came to Milwaukee and settled herself, a month later she decided to put this ad in the paper. And this friend of mine in Montreal happened to read it. It's all coincidence. If he wouldn't read it, I wouldn't be in Milwaukee. I wouldn't know about my mother. I would have lived in Montreal in a different life.
Supported by a philanthropist, Jack moved to Wisconsin to meet his mother.
In the Sunday Journal, the front page was a picture of me and my mother reunited after 6 years, not knowing about each other, not knowing who all these years. And this is how I wound up in Milwaukee.
For the War Project, I'm Justin Weimer.
Joe Meeker joins us again with a decorated veteran who stormed the beaches of Italy.
This top one is a combat infantry badge. Everybody wore that. It was in the infantry.
It's a beautiful Sunday afternoon in August, and 90-year-old veteran Howard Nelson is showing me some of the medals he acquired from his tour of duty in World War II.
And these other medals are for battles. This is the stars. Silver star and two bronze stars.
He has, among other things, a bronze star, medals for campaigns in both Africa and Italy, and at the center of his collection, a Purple Heart.
You got a brand star for each
of course,
one.
The medals represent more to Nelson than mere trinkets or keepsakes. Each one has a story behind it,
a
tale of valor, of bravery, or of pain.
Soldier, I guess.
Nelson was born and raised in Lodi, Wisconsin during the Great Depression, working on his father's farm along with his other siblings. Life was hard. The farm had to rely only on horses and simple tools to produce an ample output. Nelson quickly learned to give up luxuries, one of those luxuries being the pursuit of a higher education.
Going to school was no object for me. I couldn't afford it.
After graduating high school in 1934, Nelson was able to find work at a bus company in Madison and worked there for several years until he was drafted in 1941. Somewhat ominously, Nelson's Army career began with a start. He completed his basic training on December 7,
1941, the Pacific Ocean. A Japanese task force was also heading for Oahu. Mission, sneak attack. Primary targets, Pearl Harbor and Hickam Field.
From basic training, Nelson became a member of the 3rd Infantry Division at Fort Lewis, Washington, where he began basic amphibious training, landing ships on beaches. Though extremely proficient, the young Howard Nelson was not always what one would call a model soldier. Soon after finishing his basic training, Howard and a few of his Army buddies, in a flight of youthful fancy, went AWOL.
Well, I and two or three guys, they wanted to go home. I had a girlfriend, and the guy in St. Paul, he had a girlfriend. So why don't we go home tonight?
Thanks to the help of the base's chef, one of the only people in the base actually allowed to leave, Nelson and his compatriots crisscrossed the country, going mostly by train.
And every night the train would stop, the MPs would look for guys that would go AWOL. And we'd watch when they'd go in one end of the car, we'd go out the other end. Well, that's, how many cities we did that, so people I'm sure know what was going on.
However, Nelson's luck was not unlimited. After just a few weeks of being on the run, Nelson was caught by a pair of MPs.
And here was a big third division truck. Picked us all up, and it was, I don't know how many guys were the same way we were. They got in a boat truck and took us back to camp. Well, they had already packed up.
Thanks to that helpful bit of serendipity, Nelson went unpunished, and, along with the rest of the 3rd Division, was placed on a ship heading towards an unknown location.
We got on a ship and didn't know until we got on a ship that we were going to land in Africa.
Surprised or anxious as they may have been, the men were not willing to let morbid thoughts sully their mood further.
Well, when we got on a boat here, they gave every one of us a bag, canvas bag, that has a mattress cover. What the heck were we going to do with a mattress cover? Here, they were body bags. And everyone was supposed to carry their own body bag. Wow. Well, we weren't going to. Each one said, I'm not going to get killed. So we got over there, we sold them all to the Arabs.
After a 3-month stay in Africa, where, fortunately, Nelson had no need for a body bag, the 3rd Infantry Division was needed in Sicily. It was there that Nelson made his first amphibious landing, a successful one at that. From Sicily, the 3rd Division found themselves in a flurry of activity throughout Italy. Every time troops needed an extra push, the 3rd Division was there. From Palermo to Naples, from north to south, the 3rd Division didn't get much rest, and those inside the 3rd Division had their own theories as to why this was.
Eisenhower was always favored to the 3rd Division because he was in the 3rd Division at one time. So he always called the 3rd Division. Well, that is what happened.
The 3rd Division eventually made a landing on Anzio Beachhead in an attempt to take Naples in January 1944.
Was a pretty good sized ship, hold a couple hundred men. So then we got down the beach. They'd made a mistake, and we were the only boat landing. The communications had been mixed up somehow.
It was during this battle of desperation, the one ship of men against all the land forces on the beach, that Nelson proved just how much of a gung-ho soldier he really was.
Most of the guys on upper decks were killed, and I was a machine gunner, so I took machine guns to shore. Well, they dropped the gun. So then I went back to the boat. I don't know if I swam or, but they had a machine gun just like ours on the top of the boat. There was a Negro boy had the machine gun. He was killed. So I took the gun and went out and went back to Sicily.
From there, the 3rd Division captured Sicily before heading back to southern Italy to assist another division. When they encountered a particularly fortified German defense, the 3rd Division steeled itself for another landing on Anzio Beachhead. Almost as soon as the division reached the inland, they encountered German soldiers, and with no reinforcements, they were forced to stay on the beach for almost 3 weeks. Finally, help did arrive, and the American soldiers were able to push through in a large-scale battle. Howard was on the front lines of this assault when his life was changed forever.
And I was a master sergeant of the squad, machine gun squad. And so I was getting the other guys all up, and the mortar shell hit me in the back.
No one saw what happened to Howard after he got hit. They assumed he was missing, or worse, dead.
We were in foxholes, and I crawled back in my foxhole, and I laid there till 5 o'clock that afternoon, all day long, before someone came along and found me.
Nelson realizes how lucky he was. If it hadn't been for the runner who found him, he might not be here today. Nelson was shipped to a hospital in Naples where he was treated from June to September. However, he stayed in Italy for quite a bit longer.
I got out of the hospital in September, but I didn't get back to America until February because all the boats were busy bringing supplies up on D-Day up there. So they just left us alone.
Nelson was finished with his tour of duty. He was injured and shaken, but alive, making him one of the lucky ones.
The silent rows of dead marked the bloody beachhead that was Anzio. 7,419 strong, they are honored on Memorial Day.
Nelson married during his period of R&R and was looking forward to spending some time at home when he was told he might have to serve another tour of duty in Japan.
Here, I thought I had been wounded and been in there for almost 4 years, and here they were going to send me to Japan. But that was in July. Well, then the war was over before they had to go.
After serving his country, Nelson once again settled down in Lodi. He still lives there today. 90 years old, a little hard of hearing, but still willing to speak about his war experience. Looking at him now, one may not assume that he was once a decorated war hero. However, his medals and his memories serve as a constant reminder of his tour of duty. For The War Project, I'm Joe Meeker.
While the vast majority of Americans supported the war, there were men whose ethical, political, and religious beliefs clashed with the idea of fighting or even supporting the military in a non-combat role. Jake Pride introduces us to one man who chose prison over the army, sparking a lifetime of activism.
Before World War II started, Larry Guerra already had strong anti-war beliefs.
World War I was still fresh in the minds of Americans, and most Americans thought it was a big mistake to get into that, and it was really something that was terrible, really terrible. So there was that anti-war sentiment in the country, and then my family was anti-war, and then I had joined the Society of Friends, the Quakers, and of course they were anti-war, so I had a lot of sources.
Because of his beliefs, Guerra decided that he could not register for the draft when he turned 20.
I felt that someone had to speak out against war, not just that war, but all war, as a way of settling differences and conflict. I wanted to explain why I would not register, and I did not want to be considered a draft dodger and just not register, so I sent the district attorney a letter. I didn't send the selective service a letter because I didn't want to have anything to do with them.
Although he expected to go to prison for his actions, Guerra wasn't ready for the judge's response.
He wouldn't let me read the statement. He said I pitted my puny will against the will of Congress, but I expected some kind of a sentence, yes. In fact, I didn't even ask for a trial. I entered a plea of nulla contender, which sort of throws yourself at the mercy of the court.
Guerra was sentenced to 3 years in prison. First, he was taken to a minimum custody prison in West Virginia, Mill Point.
That place had no bars and no walls. The warden said there is a wall and it's 5 years high. In other words, if you walk beyond a certain point, you could be arrested as one who had escaped and get another 5 years. After a while there, I decided if they were going to keep me in jail, they would have to keep me in jail. I wasn't going to keep myself in there. So I told them that.
After that, Guerra and other war resistors were transferred to a medium custody prison in Ashland, Kentucky.
In Ashland, for the first 2 years, I cooperated and I worked in the hospital a while and teaching a while and in the machine shop a while. So we had a lot of discussions and even with some of the guards. Some of the guards were quite friendly. Others were very antagonistic.
One of Guerra's favorite guards was a man whose son was in the war.
It was sort of a no-nonsense approach on the part of both of us. I respected him, and he respected me, and we got along fine. Then I was released without signing any conditions because the first condition was you would obey all the laws, and the law, of course, was selective service. So they said, well, if you won't sign those conditions, we'll sign them, and they did, and they released me. And then a few months later, I was returned to prison because I hadn't fulfilled all the conditions.
This time, Guerra was taken to a maximum custody prison, Lewisburg.
A real tough place, although I was never in the general population there. I refused to cooperate, and I was in a big room with a lot of other resistors. And I might add that that was probably the only federally funded housing unit that was desegregated racially because we were all in there together. All the resistors who were so-called troublemakers, black and white. And one of them was Bayard Rustin, who became a major figure in the civil rights movement and had a tremendous impact on the thinking of Martin Luther King concerning nonviolence.
This time spent in prison had a lasting effect on Guerra.
That's a that has a tremendous impact on one's personality. It's like post-traumatic stress, you know, and I had a little of that. For years, I wouldn't want to eat in the cafeteria, stand in line. I didn't like to see authority figures in uniform and all sorts of things. I didn't do anything wild or, violent, but I had this problem I had to deal with.
Unfortunately, that wouldn't be the last time Guerra was imprisoned.
My first teaching job was at Bluffton College, And there was a student there who had refused to register. And, of course, I talked with him, but I told him on several occasions that if he felt that he was not ready for prison or that he was having second thoughts about it, he should follow that. He should not do what I did just because I did it. But then when he was arrested, I protested the arrest, and the result of that was that I got another 18-month sentence. That was after I was married and after I was into my first teaching job.
Because of his experience in World War II, Guerra believes that himself and other conscientious objectors have a lot in common with the veterans.
We had a similar experience. I mean, we were not in control of our lives. We were under the government, and we all wanted to go home.
Eventually, Guerra moved to Wilmington, where he lives today, and has since become more active in the peace movement.
For years, I organized a vigil at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base commemorating the atomic bomb. We're organizing one for Saturday a week right here for the Iraq War.
The message Guerra is trying to send to the world was described by his friend and fellow conscientious objector Bill Roberts.
It was our protest and our witness of any benefit to society. Perhaps the answer lies in the findings of the new science of chaos and complexity, which has discovered that something as apparently insignificant as the fluttering of a butterfly's wings can drastically affect the weather halfway around the globe. We flapped our butterfly wings in prison. Who can know their effect in our interconnected world? I think basically that's the heart of our message.
For The War Project, this is Jake Pratt.
The deadliest battle in World War II, the Battle of the Bulge. Natalia Hokin joins us again with a veteran who fought the German advance on the Western Front.
On a rainy August afternoon, I sat down at the kitchen table of Don Kopperweg. He confided that this was the first time he'd ever agreed to an interview about his experience as a rifleman in the Second World War.
Well, just the first I remember, well, we did a lot of walking. I was assigned to being a scout, luckily me. The first time I would go into these villages and we would enter our homes, and I can remember the first one I went in, I had to push in the door. I couldn't speak French, or and I hollered, I would say American, they wouldn't come out, so I kept hollering. I was about ready to throw a hand grenade down. And then they say, no krauts, no krauts. That's what they call the Germans, no krauts. And that's the way we went through some of the villages.
I wondered if he ever felt bad about what he was doing.
We knew we had a job to do, and I guess we'd do it. We done it. This guy I met down in Omaha Beach, he said, Don, he said, you go up there and do what they tell you to do, but don't try to be a hero. And he said, you'll be all right. And I guess that stuck in my mind all the way through.
Don Kopperweg fought in the Battle of the Bulge, which began in December of 1944 in the forested regions of eastern Belgium and northern Luxembourg.
We had our summer clothes on yet. That was down fairly well, not summer, but fall clothes, just light jacket. And no boots or anything. And then when they delivered clothing up there, they brought a big truckload up and dumped it in the street, and we went and picked out what we wanted that would fit us.
The Battle of the Bulge was a surprise German offensive. Their goal was to split the Allied line and force a negotiated peace on the Western Front. They did not succeed. They did, however, create a bulge in the Allied line, and 19,000 Americans were killed in World War II's bloodiest battle.
We lost more men in the Battle of the Bulge than we did either on Pearl Harbor or Normandy. We come back in one evening or congregated to see what happened that day or talk it over as much as we could. And they asked for volunteers. They had to go in and carry out the injured, so I volunteered. And when I got there, here was this, my partner, my other scout that worked with me. Hutchinson was his name, and I carried him out. We put him on the Jeep, and he took him back, and what happened, he'd run into evidently a machine gun or something. We were all pretty much buddies, you know, got to know everybody pretty well. But they came and go pretty regular.
Like many of his fellow soldiers, Kopervig's feet were badly frostbitten in the cold. He was put on medical leave and remained in recovery for over a month.
And when the doctor said, I got pretty well acquainted with the doctor by then, Don, he said, I've just got a release. He said, we don't usually keep anybody here over a month. But, he said, I'm not going to send you back to the front lines. Afterwards, maybe I thought I would like to join my unit in the 80th Division, but I'd have got back there, I wouldn't have known anybody anyway. Because I report come back to the hospital, the unit where we left, where they had a counterattack, and they said your unit was completely wiped out. So true or false, I don't know, only what he said.
After the war, Kopervig found it difficult to talk about his experiences, even to his brother, who joined the service a month after Don.
We actually never ever talked about our experiences in war. Never did. And, well, we'd get talking sometime over a beer sometime, and get, and it used to make a guy sweat, just like I'm starting to now. But it was an experience. And if you're not there, you can't imagine what it was like.
For The War Project, I'm Natalia Hoken.
Baseball flourished as a national pastime during World War II. In fact, President Roosevelt famously wrote, "It would be best for the country to keep baseball going." While many players were drafted into the military, they continued to take the field during their service. Justin Weimer talks to a man who laced up his cleats for the U.S. Army.
Growing up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Mort Commissar's aptitude for baseball and football was apparent.
There was only one touchdown scored against us. One touchdown. Every game was like 49-0.
Mort's two older brothers were already fighting in Europe when he was drafted into the Army. Because the war was almost over, Mort did not need to go overseas.
They said, we'll make a deal with you. Instead of being drafted, which I was, we'll give you $100 and you'll be... You come in for a set time, for like a year and a half.
Despite being an exception, Commissar still needed to go to basic training.
Now, in basic training, they had a baseball player that played with the Dodgers, and he was 16 years old. 16! He played with the Brooklyn Dodgers at that time. And I says, I want to play too.
Mort finished basic training and began to play sports against other Army League teams.
There's a lot of soldiers in the camp. They like to have entertainment for the troops. And we played baseball in the afternoon, and that's why we were exempt from duty. We just played ball and that's it.
The experience, however, was not just fun and games. Mort was attacked by a fellow troop wielding a knife.
there was a Mexican, it was a friend of mine, and he tripped him on the way, so he couldn't get by. And they gave him an army discharge. That's what he wanted. He wanted to go after because he didn't want to be in the army.
Commissar was not completely detached from the war in Europe. After he was released from the army, he lived near a German prisoner of war detention facility.
I just found out that they were there, and so I went there, and I speak to them in Yiddish, and they understood. I said, "Was machst du etwas? What's happening?" They look just like in the movies.
Even though they were not fighting in Europe, Mort Commissar and many others fought a different battle during World War II. Through baseball, they provided the necessary entertainment and distraction to millions of Americans and soldiers. For The War Project, I'm Dustin Weiner.
The government interned 120,000 Americans of Japanese descent during the war. In our final story this hour, Jake Pride talks to a man who experienced this internment as a boy.
Glenn Kumasaka's family owned a store in Tacoma, Washington. He was 13 years old when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
That Sunday, I happened to be at another family's store. We were making a model airplane. Then the radio came on and said the Pearl Harbor, you know, there was bombing in Pearl Harbor.
December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
And we just thought it was just another one of those terrible news attack against us, and we just kind of blocked it off. Suddenly, there were no customers coming.
The Japanese in Tacoma were lucky because they had one of the only sympathetic mayors, who encouraged the people to be very good to the Japanese living there. While Kumasaka and his family might have been worried about guns being fired through their windows or similar dangers, in Tacoma they had much simpler things to worry about.
Being a child, my worst worry was how my friends at school would greet me when I went to school on Monday. But everybody was so nice to me.
At first, the government was rushed to move all the Japanese Americans as soon as possible.
Neither the Army nor the War Relocation Authority relished the idea of taking men, women, and children from their homes, their shops, and their farms. So the military and civilian agencies alike determined to do the job as a democracy should, with real consideration for the people involved.
With some exceptions, depending on where they lived, they were given 2 weeks' notice and sent to improvised camps called assembly centers before they were moved to their actual camps.
The Seattle people were put into Puyallup State Fair, and we were still free, so we used to go there to bring them fruits or toothpaste through the fences.
Eventually, Kumasaka and his family were relocated.
We were put into a train, and we were trained down in the dark, 3.5 days about, to a camp outside of Fresno.
The camp they were taken to is a former lumber camp where they stayed for a few months before being taken to a camp called Tula Lake. Teachers were recruited later, so for several months the kids really had nothing to do and no responsibilities. This is quite a change of pace for children accustomed to not only going to school but also helping with the family business. But they found ways to pass the time.
We try to get catalogs, you know, Sears Roebuck catalog and Montgomery catalog. We used to look at all kinds of pictures of what kind of things we like to buy, you know, boots and all that. We just kind of daydreamed in many ways.
Still, their condition was far from ideal.
The Army provided housing and plenty of healthful, nourishing food for all.
And in a large, unpainted mess hall. And it would fill up and empty in 20 minutes. It was not that appetizing.
But they were able to cope with their condition.
There is a Japanese word, shikata ga nai, which literally means you can't do anything about it. That's the way life is. And that's the attitude of our parents. They just were so stoical, calm. They never became angry. They just accepted things.
Even after being moved from their homes and forced to stay in camps, many of those interned were not only peaceful, they were helpful.
I did volunteer to help make school furnitures. But basically, we just let a life that was pretty like any children in a way.
After the war ended, the Japanese were left with no clear place to go.
Can you imagine how it felt for a father or mother after being in camp for 3.5 years with their finances to rock bottom? Suddenly said the government says, okay, get out. And you say, where are we going?
The camp administrator set up a counseling system for them to decide what to do.
She asked my father, what do you hope for? And my father said, I want a good education for my children. That's all he said. And at that time, my older sister had just graduated from high school. And she sang and played the piano. So our counselor from Buffalo said, without a second, Eastman School of Music, Rochester, New York.
Kumasaka, his older sister, and his grandfather went ahead of the rest of the family to find a place to stay.
They just dropped out there. So here are three of us. First time in 3.5 years, we're outside of camp. A train came in and left without us because it was filled with returning soldiers from the Pacific. Another train came, again left.
Kumasaka's grandfather slipped the station attendant a dollar to help them get on the train.
So when the next train came, he threw our suitcases on the train. So we jumped on, and it was filled with soldiers. So we sat on those suitcases for 2.5 days. Then one night, my sister woke me up and said, we better jump off because those soldiers are threatening us.
They jumped off the train in Omaha, Nebraska, where they stayed overnight and made it to Rochester the following day. After his grandmother, mother, and father arrived, they looked for jobs for 3 months but couldn't find any.
Thanksgiving came, and we ate our Thanksgiving dinner, and we sat on the floor because we didn't have any chairs. Our table was a packing box, and we had chicken. And then my dad said this, things look very rough now, but it'll be better. We'll find a job. We're all here together, healthy. Thank God we're in America. Can you imagine being in Japan now? I don't know how he had the strength and the faith to say such a thing. I don't know how he said it. He was such a simple, grateful man.
Kumasaka's mother got a job as a seamstress, and his father and grandfather got jobs in a hotel where they worked for 10 years and managed to get their kids through college.
They sacrificed 10 years of their lives, and when I think of that, I cry inside that I never appreciated such a fantastic strength and sacrifice they made for us for our education. We learn from our parents, and I finally come to the conclusion we also look at the world as shikata ga nai. You can't do anything about it. That's past. We gotta look to the future.
For the War Project, this is Jake Pride.
Give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze and listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in.
Just turn me loose, let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western sky. On my cayuse, let me wander over yonder till I see the mountains rise.
I want to ride to the ridge where the west commences and gaze at the moon till I lose my senses, and I can't look at hobbles and I can't stand fences. Don't fence me in.
Oh, give me land, lots of land under starry skies. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide country that I love. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze and listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in. Just turn me loose, let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western skies.
On my cayuse, let me wander over yonder till I see the mountains rise.
Ba 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 ba. I want to ride to the ridge where the west commences and gaze at the moon till I lose my senses. And I can't look at hobbles and I can't stand fences. Don't fence me in. No,
Papa, don't you fence me in.
The War Project was produced by Joe Meeker,
Natalia Hoken,
Justin Weimer,
and Jake Pride,
with production and technical assistance from Joe Hardkey
and the staff at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Special thanks to Marta Bechtol,
Swarthmore College, KNAU in Flagstaff, Arizona,
and the staff of Wisconsin Public Radio News.
The War Project's website was produced with financial support from WETA Television
in conjunction with Ken Burns' The War.
The War Project was produced as part of the Soundwaves Youth Media Project,
a collaborative partnership between the Educational Communications Board,
Wisconsin Public Radio,
Wisconsin Public Television,
and teachers and students from across the state.
For more information about student radio project opportunities,
visit ecb.org/soundwaves.
Additional multimedia project activities
for students surrounding World War II
can be found at ecb.org/warletters.
Thanks for listening.
Throw this at the end of the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Had a lot of good memories.